The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, let's get back to our serious business here. get back to our deep thinking. We were talking about Kant last time, and notice I put another new wrinkle up on the board. I put my little rectangle with the two corners circled. I think Kant is a particularly clear example of the square. Kant, has this the rationalistic side and the irrationalistic on the upper right-hand corner and the rationalistic side on the lower right-hand corner. Kant is an irrationalist in the sense that he puts God in the noumenal world. He says that the truth about God and ultimately the truth about anything cannot be known. It's impossible really to know the world as it really is. He also argues that within that sphere of experience that's open to us, we can have virtually exhaustive knowledge. So you have a rationalistic side and you have an irrationalistic side, corresponding with with certain doctrines of transcendence and immanence. In Kant's view, God is transcendent in the sense that he is beyond the world of our experience. God is transcendent in the sense that he cannot be clearly known. He cannot reveal himself unambiguously in the creation. God is so far beyond us, so far above us, that he cannot be intelligibly described or understood. Nevertheless, when God does come into contact with the world, when God does come into the phenomenal world, he submits himself to human categories. So whenever he does reveal himself, whenever he speaks, that word of God has to be analyzed and it has to be evaluated by human reason, by autonomous human reason. When God acts in the world, his actions turn out to be just like all other actions, just like all other natural events. They must fit into the causal sequence. They must adapt themselves to be like all the other events that happen within the creation, so that when God speaks in creation, when God acts in creation, his speech and action is indistinguishable from the speech and action of creatures, so that you have both transcendence and immanence. You have the idea that God is so transcendent as to be removed from experience. You have the idea that God is so immanent as to be indistinguishable from the rest of our experience. When God enters our experience, he takes on the attributes of creatures and he relinquishes his divine attributes so as to become, in effect, a creature himself. So you have that kind of dialectic moving in Immanuel Kant. Now, this provides a very tempting scheme for theologians to use. And I was telling you at the end of the hour last time how many theologians of our day have succumbed to that temptation. Because using that scheme, you see, you can talk about God as both transcendent and immanent. You can talk about God as being exalted above the world. You can also talk about God as being in the world and involved with the world. And in both cases, you can use that language without bringing any real challenge against your own autonomy. So you find that Kant has been tremendously influential on theology, both 19th century theology and 20th century theology. The 19th century theology, of course, emphasized the immanence of God. The 20th century theology, at least the neo-orthodoxy of Barth and people like that, emphasizes the transcendence of God. But this is transcendence and immanence within the general framework of Kantian philosophy. So when you hear somebody say there are two realms, one is the realm of science, the other is the realm of religion, and you shouldn't mix up the two, well, you've got the Kantian structure there that people are operating with. When people talk as Buber and Brunner and others do, distinguishing sharply between a world of objects and a world of persons, distinguishing sharply between the it dimension and the thou dimension, the dimension in which we treat things as objects and the dimension in which we treat things as we act as persons. There you have also the traditional Kantian framework. When people distinguish between a realm of historical fact that occurs in time and space and can be dated on a calendar, and then distinguish sharply between that and the overall value judgments that we make about those facts, the realm of history and the realm of Geschichte, two different kinds of history, you find again the typical Kantian structure at work. So you're reading some contemporary theology in Kant's book, and you ought to be constantly seeing most all of those theologies will fit into the Kantian framework. If not, it's probably because they're modified in the direction of Hegel, and we'll talk about Hegel a moment later. When people say, just a few more illustrations, when people say that God does not reveal propositions, he reveals himself. Again, that's what William Hordern said in your reading earlier this year. It's the same kind of scheme that's being operated on. The realm of propositions is the phenomenal world. You can make propositions, you can make truth judgments about phenomena. But, of course, God is not concerned to reveal judgments about phenomena authoritatively. No, that's not his business. His business is to reveal himself as a person. And somehow that personal relationship has to be seen as something very different from the revealing of propositions. Now, from a biblical point of view, we certainly want to emphasize the personal character of our relationship with God. But we don't want to say that a personal relationship excludes the revealing of truth between the two persons. And that's the sort of thing that seems to be done in contemporary theology to some extent, and it's done under the influence of Kantian philosophy. So this sort of thing can explain a great deal that's very mysterious to you, perhaps, with regard to contemporary theology. Now, I want to move on to the next thinker, to Hegel. Hegel is the father of a school of philosophy known as idealism. Now, I've already told you that idealism is a broad general term, is the view that all of reality has the character of mind. I mentioned that Leibniz was a kind of rationalistic idealist, and I mentioned that Berkeley was a kind of empiricist idealist. Well, this is a special kind of idealism that, sometimes when people use the term idealism, they're thinking of this broad general category. Sometimes when they use the term idealism, they're thinking narrowly of the school of philosophy that was begun by Hegel. Actually, you could argue that it wasn't actually begun by Hegel. Hegel had a couple of predecessors, Fichte being one and Schelling being another. Hegel came at the consummation of the development in Germany, but generally speaking, Hegel is the most prominent name that's associated with this kind of thinking. I mention a lot of other names up there The main reason I mention all those names is because you run into them from time to time in Van Til's writings. The next three after Fichte and Schelling, well, you first have the German trio, Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel. That's the order generally in which they wrote. Then a little bit later in the 19th century, you have Green, T.H. Green, and Bradley, F.H. Bradley, and Bernard Bosanquet. These are three British idealists. Later in the 19th century, idealism crossed the English Channel, which is a very remarkable achievement for a philosophy, to cross the English Channel. And so idealism came to dominate the British Isles in the latter part of the 19th century. And then in the United States, the principal idealist about the around the turn of the century was a man named Josiah Royce, who taught at Harvard. And then since that time, idealism has become very much a minority movement in philosophy. There aren't very many people today who would call themselves idealists, but you do find idealists around, and perhaps the most prominent idealist in the United States since the time of Royce has been Brand Blanchard. Blanchard, who taught at Yale for many years, retired fairly recently. I mention all these names. Dr. Van Til studied under idealist philosophers at Princeton University back in the 1920s. And there's a great deal of the language of idealism that comes into Van Til's system. A lot of the questions that Van Til asks are very much influenced by the language of idealism. So you can't learn a lot about Van Til by learning about idealism. Remember, of course, that Van Til has rejected the idealist approach in principle, but he still, of course, you know, anything you study helps you to ask questions. Anything that you study gives you ideas, and Van Til has picked up a lot of ideas in the course of studying idealism that he might not have picked up otherwise. All right, so now remember everything that's going on since Kant is really contemporary, you know. We're really talking about contemporary thought now. When we talk about Kant, when we talk about Hegel, I told you how so much contemporary theology is Kantian. Hegel has his disciples today. There's, in fact, Bob Knudsen and others have told me that there's a Hegel Renaissance going on. Just recently there was a conference on Hegel held at Villanova University. You may have seen that advertised on the bulletin board. The Renaissance of Marxism has kind of gone along with a renewed attention to Hegel. So this is all very much in the air right now, and who knows, that maybe the next generation of theologians is going to be Hegelian rather than Marxist. It's hard to tell, but all of this is very much in the air right now. So from this point on, you ought to pay close attention. All right, what's Hegel up to? What are the idealists up to? First of all, they eliminate the noumenal world of Kant. I told you that there were all kinds of problems in Kant with the noumenal world, or the so-called Ding on sich. idealists argue that there is nothing that is unknowable. There is nothing that is completely beyond our experience. And in this respect, idealism is a rationalist position. I think that you can describe idealism as a rejuvenated form of rationalism, if you will. If there is such a thing as a Ding on sich, if there is something that's unknowable, then the idealist says you ought to be consistent with that affirmation and not try to talk about the Ding on sich. Don't try to reason about it. Don't include it in your system. Don't even refer to it. And if you don't refer to it, then, of course, the only world you do talk about is the knowable world. The only world that has any function in a philosophy is the world that we can reason about. And so that implies that we can reason about the whole world. There's nothing beyond our knowledge. There's nothing that we can't talk about. There's nothing that we can't know. There is no Ding on Zik. There is no noumenal. There is nothing beyond our understanding. Well, that's the argument that's been used by rationalists from time immemorial. That's the kind of argument that lies behind Parmenides' rationalism, lies behind Plato's rationalism. There can't be anything unknowable, because if it's unknowable, you can't speak of it. But what you can speak of must correspond in some way to the mind. And Hegel argues that the real is the rational, and the rational is the real. That's a good, strong statement of philosophical rationalism. Furthermore, the idealist argues that if Kant felt that we have to presuppose God, if Kant feels that we have to presuppose certain things in order to make moral judgments, so the existence of God, the unity of the world, the reality of the self, let's be serious about that. Let's not say that these things are unknowable. Let's not just, if we're going to act as if these are true, let's believe that they're true. Let's make these presuppositions an aspect of philosophy. Let's make these presuppositions part of our thinking. Let's really presuppose them. Let's not just pretend that we're presupposing. Let's really presuppose them. And by the way, idealism developed a whole theory of presuppositions. And this is at least where Dr. Van Til, I imagine, started to think about presuppositions and the role of presuppositions in knowledge. Bradley wrote a book called The Presuppositions of Critical History. Bosanquet wrote various books on logic, where he sets forth the importance of presuppositions in developing arguments and so on. We have here a kind of generic rationalism, but now it's a chastened rationalism. It's not a rationalism just like Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz. It's not a rationalism that has unlimited confidence in the ability of the human mind, because the Hegelians realized that that Hume and Kant had raised some real problems with rationalism. They had raised some real problems about knowledge. They've shown how difficult it is to be sure of things in various areas. Kant showed that, or at least showed very plausibly, the view that there are limits upon our reason. Kant argued, for instance, that you can prove that the world has a beginning, and you can also prove that the world doesn't have a beginning. And both of these proofs look perfectly all right. There's no way of showing that the one proof is superior to the other. Nevertheless, you get caught in a contradiction because you're trying to transcend your experience. Well, that's sort of argument. It was seemed to be a very powerful argument. And the idealists then had to do something about that. If they're going to bring rationalism back into the picture, they had to do something about these powerful skeptical arguments that David Hume and Immanuel Kant brought into the philosophical arena. Well, the idealist answers Kant in somewhat the following way. He says the problem here, the problem with this antinomy, for instance, where you can prove one thing and you can also prove its opposite, the idealist says that the problem is not so much that the mind makes a mistake, or that the mind is limited, or that the mind is inadequate to do the job. The problem is that for the time being, the mind sees only one aspect of the truth. For the time being, we have seen only one aspect of the truth. Now take the old argument against empiricism. Some people feel hot, some people feel cold. The stick in the water appears to be bent, and yet you know that it's straight. Your senses seem to deceive you. Well, the idealist looks at that in this kind of way. He says, look, you look at this stick that's in the water, and you misinterpret it, you think that it's bent, because you don't put it in a broad enough context. Now, what you see, your senses aren't deceiving you. Your senses are reporting the data accurately. But in seeing that, you misinterpret it because you don't see it in the larger context. You don't. You need to have some more information in order to interpret what you're seeing. You need to see that single fact in the light of a larger number of facts. Now, all mistakes, all problems have that kind of structure. Where the mind is having a problem, it's simply a symptom that the mind has not seen enough. You simply haven't seen this fact in a broad enough context. And so when Kant shows that you can prove this and you can also prove its opposite, okay, sure, the mind is having problems there. It has a problem because it doesn't see broadly enough. It doesn't see enough of the reality in order to see just where, what conclusion it should derive. As a matter of fact, argues Hegel, this is the way we achieve truth. You see, we have an idea, and then that idea is challenged. Okay? Truth proceeds by challenge. You have an idea, and then you see that there's something wrong with that idea. You get an idea, and then you see an objection to that idea. And you see some truth, but then you think about it some more, and you see that there's some truth in the objection, but there's also some truth in your original idea. And when you see your own idea and you see the objection and you put them together and you work them out, you come to see it, both of them in a larger context. You come to a more adequate idea. You come to a broader idea. Now, this is the sort of thing that I advocate in my little pamphlet, How to Study for My Courses. I tell you that the way to achieve clarity, cogency, and profundity is to anticipate objections, all right? When you're working on a theological idea, when you're working on an apologetic idea, you think you've got some insight. The best way to improve your insight is to think, well, how would somebody object to this? What would somebody say if they were arguing on the other side? And once you see how somebody would object, then how do you work that out? How do you work out that conflict? And very often, in working out that conflict, you come to a better view. You come to a view which is clearer. You come to a view which is more cogent. You come to a view which is more profound. And so we find truth through challenge. That's point two on the outline up front. You find truth through negating your original ideas and then working toward a fuller idea. This, of course, is the idea behind Plato's dialogues, too, right? Here somebody comes along and he presents an idea, and then Socrates says, oh, no, that's not the way it is, and he presents another idea, and then they argue about it, they debate about it. And finally, what they come to at the end, hopefully, is a better idea than either of them had at the beginning. So you have that sort of process. Basically, it's just a fairly common sense notion, just a dialogue structure which leads to a more adequate perception of the whole, a more adequate perception of the broader context of things. I think it's wrong. Some people have found in Hegel a kind of, there are people who say that Hegel rejects the law of non-contradiction, or that Hegel rejects the distinction between true and false, and he opts for truth as some kind of amalgam of truth and falsity. That's not really right. I don't think that's a very good way of understanding Hegel. I think what he's doing is simply showing how we come to achieve more truth He's not mixing up truth and falsity. He's not trying to do away with that distinction. He's simply saying, look, you have an idea which has some truth in it and some falsehood. How are you going to minimize the truth? Well, you're going to put it in a larger context, and you're going to get to the point where you have much more truth and much less falsehood. It's fairly popular in the studies of Hegel to show then Hegel's dialectic along the following lines. You start with a thesis. That's the original idea that you have. And then you move on to an antithesis. That's the opposite of the first. And then you discover that there's some truth in the original idea. There's also some truth in its opposite. And when you see the truth in both of those, you come to a larger view, which is called the synthesis. Now, the synthesis includes elements of both the thesis and the antithesis. Now, Hegel doesn't very often use that language. Basically, there are a few places where he uses that language, mainly when he's discussing Kant. You know, Kant said, well, you have the thesis that the world had a beginning, and then you have the antithesis that the world did not have a beginning, and both of these seem to be provable. Well, Hegel says, no, you shouldn't stop with the thesis and the antithesis. You ought to move beyond. You ought to see what truth there is in both those ideas, and then move on to the synthesis. The synthesis is not a synthesis of truth or truth and falsehood. It's something that, again, it has elements of truth in it, and it has elements of falsehood, and Hegel is quite capable of distinguishing between those. But then that synthesis then will produce another antithesis, all right? That synthesis becomes a thesis for a further advance in knowledge. So then you think of some objection to your new synthesis. And you see some truth in the original, in the synthesis. You see some truth in the antithesis. And then you come to a higher view, which is a further synthesis. And so you move on and on and on until you gain a knowledge of the whole, until you gain a knowledge of the whole. Now, Hegel argues that in this way, you can be a good rationalist. You can say that the mind has access to truth, but you can also deal with these problems that have always been raised against the rationalists, namely that our senses deceive us and our reason winds up in paradoxes. The paradoxes themselves are part of the way in which we achieve truth. Negations, the problems, and so on, they impel us. They help us to see the world as it really is. Change and plurality, all of these things that Aristotle associated with matter, these are not to be simply discarded in the search for truth. These are ways of helping us see the world as it really is, in all its particularity. And so when you achieve the totality, when you finally get to the point where you know everything, you've included all the change in your system. You've included all of the plurality in your system. You've given account of matter, in Aristotle's terminology. You've given account of everything. And so the final system that you finally work out is a concrete universal. Now that term appears in Van Til. It's not an abstract universal like Plato's forms, which leave out all the characteristics of matter, but it's a concrete universal. It's a universal which includes all the change, all the plurality, all the particularity within it as it moves on to the ultimate. All right, so through this system then, the reason can include within itself the problems and achieve its own ends. The mind then does have access to ultimate reality. Now, it's more than just saying that we're capable of understanding the world. There's even more to it than that for an idealist. Because, you see, it's not enough to have ideas which correspond with the world. For an idealist, that's not enough.
Because if you just have ideas which correspond with the world, then there's still a difference between your idea and the world. Okay? There's still a difference. There's still a discrepancy. There's still a disparity. If I have an idea of that chair, well, there's still a difference between the idea, even if it's a perfect idea, even if it's a perfectly adequate idea, there's still a difference because I don't have a chair in my head. My idea is not a chair, and the chair is not an idea. So there's always that discrepancy. There's something that the idea cannot catch. And according to Hegel and according to the idealists, if you're going to have really adequate knowledge, it's not enough to have correspondence. All of the differences between the idea and the reality must be overcome. The mind must be equivalent to its object. The mind must be identical with its object. And Hegel argues that as you gain greater and greater knowledge, as the mind grows through this dialectical process of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, as you grow, as you develop, as you get more and more facts into your mind, that's exactly what happens. Your mind becomes more and more, to a greater and greater extent, identical with the things that it knows. And in the final consummation, in the eschaton, at the fulfillment of this process, there will be no difference between the mind and the universe. Mind and universe will be identical to one another. And this identity is, this identity is the fulfillment of the self. And it can also be called God, the fullness of everything. The absolute is another word that Hegel uses to describe this fulfilled consummation situation. The absolute God, the self in its fulfillment, the fulfillment of the process of reason. Now, in a sense, that final state is with us now, okay? In Hegel, there's an already and there's a not yet. Now, you say to yourself, well, look, there's still this difference between my mind and the chair. I still don't know the whole. I still don't know the totality. So I'm sort of on my way. I haven't gotten there yet. Yeah, that's true in a sense for Hegel. But you see, there's still this old rationalistic argument that Plato used, and Hegel hasn't outgrown it. And that is that if it's possible to know the truth, if it's possible to grow in knowledge, then in some sense we must have that knowledge already. Remember the little story about the slave who drew the geometrical diagrams in the sand, and through skillful questioning, he got the whole system of geometry out of his own head. Well, Hegel has some of that idea too, that somehow this unity between the self and the world already exists, although it has to be realized, although it's yet to be realized. There's a paradoxical unity and difference between the mind and the world. In a sense, God is in process. In a sense, God is incomplete. And yet, in another sense, God already exists. In a sense, the world is already unified in God. Here, idealism becomes very, very difficult to follow. And I won't try to explain it to you any more than that, except to indicate that, again, you have this notion of thought thinking itself that we found in Kant. Basically, the process of knowledge is the process of understanding your own mind. Basically, the process of knowledge is the process of understanding the workings of your own thought. And when you understand the workings of your own thought, you understand the world. And when you understand the world, you understand yourself. And when you understand both of them, you are understanding God. And ultimately, there is no distinction between God and the world, although in another sense, God is the fulfillment of the process. Now, if this seems paradoxical to you, if this seems difficult to understand, I'd maintain that this is just, again, the same old story that you have with all non-Christian philosophy. Here you have the rationalistic side, that there is an identity between thoughts and things, that the mind already has all the knowledge it needs, that all knowledge is within us. On the other hand, you have the irrationalistic side, that somehow, and for whatever reason we don't know, somehow there's yet something to be learned. Somehow we don't have the whole truth. As a matter of fact, we won't have the whole truth until we won't have any truth until we reach the whole. We don't really know anything until we know everything. And we don't, in a sense, right now, we don't know everything. And so here's the irrationalistic side of Hegel, that the truth is in the whole, and we don't have the whole yet, so we don't really have the truth yet. And there's this vacillation, then, between rationalism and irrationalism. It's also a vacillation between the transcendence of God and the immanence of God. God is transcendent because he is not yet complete. This is that kind of temporal transcendence that Strimpel was talking about in connection with the theology of hope. God is transcendent because he is yet, the full consummation is yet to come. On the other hand, God is immanent because he's already identical with my processes of thinking and identical with the total world situation. Here, and how do you reconcile these? How do you get them together? Well, ultimately, it's mysterious. Ultimately, it's something I believe that cannot be done in terms of the Hegelian system. Now, having said some things about, so you see those last two points there in the outline, rationalism, Hegel's statement that the real is the rational is the real, irrationalism, the truth is only in the whole, it's only in the absolute, and all partial knowledge then is inadequate. Partial knowledge will mislead and distort. Now, I think having taken a look at Kant and having taken a look at Hegel, you're now in a much better position to understand existentialism. And let me go back to Knudsen's lectures on existentialism for a moment. I'm a little sorry that you got those out of order. But I think now you can go back to your notes that you took from Dr. Knudsen, and you can see certain issues more clearly. I would argue that, in existentialism, you have, particularly in the writings of Soren Kierkegaard, and Kierkegaard is not, whether you call him an existentialist or not, isn't too important. Kierkegaard is very important to the existentialists, and Kierkegaard is, in a sense, the one who got the existential movement started. Kierkegaard, I better spell him for you if you haven't heard the name. Kierkegaard represents, I think, a kind of Kantian reaction against Hegelianism, but it's kind of a retreat to Kant, but it's fortified with a lot of elements of Hegel. Kierkegaard was very, very angry with the idea that you could include everything in a system, and he felt that the Hegelian rationalism was something very much to be despised. It was a bad philosophy, and he argued it was particularly bad philosophy. If you're going to try to be a Christian, you have to allow for much more freedom than that. You have to you can't claim that everything is wrapped up in a system. Salvation, after all, is by faith. It's something that we don't have reasons for. You have to rest on the Lord. You have to rest on Christ without having it all worked out in your mind. And so Kierkegaard, on both theological and philosophical grounds, was very much opposed to the Hegelian system. Now, Kierkegaard, I think, in a way, moves back to the Kantian type of framework, where you have a realm of where reason functions adequately, namely the realm of science, the realm of ordinary life. But if you're going to commit yourself to Jesus Christ, if you're going to become truly religious, you have to leap out of this whole framework, this whole way of looking at things as objects. Now, I think that the existential movement as a whole tends to have that kind of structure. But in some existentialists, you have a little bit more respect for idealism, and in other existentialists, you have more of a Kantian sort of structure. Let me present a few elements of modern existentialism that seem to derive from Kant, and then a few elements that seem to derive more from Hegel and from idealism. First of all, with regard to the Kantian side, I think you can see an awful lot of Kant in Jean-Paul Sartre, for instance. Sartre argues that you're bound to miss the boat in your life if you think of yourself as an object. For instance, if you simply play out a role, he uses the illustration of a waiter who waits on you, and there are certain motions of the body that are associated with being a waiter. He carries the plates in a certain way. He lays the food down on the table in a certain way. He says certain things to you, and there are other things that he may have in his mind that he doesn't say because he's a waiter, and waiters don't say those things. And there are other things that waiters do say because they're waiters. Now, in his ordinary life, he may talk very differently. He may walk very differently. He may have an entirely different approach. But while he's a waiter, he behaves as a waiter just because he is one. And we all fall into these roles all the time, don't we? Businessmen tend to act like businessmen because they know that role. And teachers tend to act like teachers. They tend to act out roles. Now, Sartre says that if you're really going to live authentically, if you're going to live the way you ought to live, you ought to get away from those roles. You ought to break out of those roles. You ought to express what you really are and not simply the station that you have in life. And here again, I think you have some echoes of the Kantian scheme, the phenomenal world in which everything is pretty well categorized, in which all your roles are set out for you. You know what you can do. You can evaluate it rationally and so on. And then the noumenal realm, in which you have freedom, in which you have the freedom to express yourself authentically. And, of course, the noumenal world is the realm of values. That's where you achieve real value. That's where you achieve real significance and importance in your life. On the other hand, you also have a kind of Hegelian thrust in some forms of existentialism, particularly among those existentialists who want to escape from mere psychology. Now, Knudsen talked to you about some existentialists who criticize others for being mere psychologists. Well, if you simply talk in terms of Sartre's illustrations and talk about authentic existence and how you should behave on the basis of roles or on the basis of something else, you might be accused of being a mere psychologist. But as a matter of fact, most existentialists want to go beyond that. They want to take the role of the self as a kind of key to the very nature of being, as Heidegger put it, as a way back into the ground of metaphysics. They want to assimilate these negations that we find in life in order to understand what true being is. Now, at this point, of course, you can see an echo of the Hegelian dialectic. Hegel trying to absorb the negations, Hegel trying to absorb the negativities, the minus line in Knudsen's diagram, trying to absorb those things into a more adequate understanding of the nature of the world. Now, at this point, of course, if you press that line too far, then you get a Kantian protest. you get Kierkegaard speaking out again, saying, look, aren't you just going back to the old metaphysics? I remember Knudsen presenting that also as an intramural criticism within existentialism. You're going back to the old metaphysics. You're trying to reduce everything to a system. You're trying to entrap man in this in this system of your devising. Well, So you can see then how the existentialists get trapped in the kind of bind that Knudsen was describing there, trying to affirm reason, trying to develop a real understanding of the world, while at the same time trying to express their freedom. Marxism, we could say a word about Marxism also in this kind of context. Marxism represents a kind of demythologizing of Hegel. It was once said that Marx turned Hegel on his head. That wasn't quite right. I think the actual what Marx said was more along these lines, that Hegel himself was like a man standing on his head. Hegel thought that all of reality moved along in terms of reason, in terms of ideas, in terms of thinking, that you could analyze history as if it followed the structure of the mind. And Marx argues, no, that's not the way it works. The great events of history come about as a result of economic factors. They come about as a result of political factors. So you've got to get your feet down on the ground. You've got to see what really impels the dialectic along. And so Marx then argues for a dialectical materialism, not a dialectical idealism, but a dialectical materialism, arguing that various economic factors produce produce conflicts and eventually revolutions and so on and so forth. Well, that then is the process by which dialectical philosophy came into the mainstream of philosophy, and that is very much still with us. There are Marxist theologians, there are Hegelian theologians, there are Kantian theologians, there are existentialist theologians, and that whole movement is very much a part of our own scene today. Bruce? No, Hegel did publish a number of lectures on the philosophy of history. Now, I don't know whether those... I think maybe those were lecture notes that were taken by his students, and I'm not sure that that title is his. But he did very definitely think that the course of history imitates the process of the mind. In fact, as I indicated earlier, there's more than a correlation here. There's actually a unity. So that Hegel felt that once you understand the workings of your mind, you can understand the way history develops. And Hegel argued that, that this is the way it happens. And he felt that the historical dialectic had reached its consummation in the Prussian state of his day. Now, people look back on that and they kind of laugh at it, I suppose rightly so, but Hegel really did feel that he could trace the course of history in that kind of way. Chris? Well, the freedom side, I think, is mainly comes mainly from Kant. Now, the Hegelians, of course, try to incorporate that. They try to do justice to it in terms of their system. But then the Kantians reply, look, you can't get freedom into a system, all right? You just can't do it that way. Now, what this means is that in every existentialist, there's a kind of tenuous balance between those two motifs. And each of them looks at the other, and he sees the one moving a little too far in one direction, then he'll criticize it. Yes?
Would Heidegger be an example of an existentialist who had the Hegelian emphasis?
Yes, I think somewhat more than Jaspers and Sartre, yes. I thought everybody had questions to ask. Well, okay. All right. Just a few words on some other 19th century movements. I think we can handle them in 3 minutes. remember that during the 19th century, empiricism is still going on. Now, I mentioned empiricism to you in connection with Locke, Berkeley, and Hume, the doctrine that you have to begin with your sense experience and so on. John Stuart Mill is the chief representative of British empiricism in the 19th century. Mill is faced particularly, well, he's famous for a lot of things, but he's faced particularly with the challenge of Kant. Kant is saying, look, you empiricists had better find a basis for math and science. And Mill very seriously tries to go about that task. He tries to develop a basis for math and science without the Kantian apparatus, you see. He tries to do it without the phenomenal-noumenal distinction, without the idea that reality is structured by the mind. Mill tries to base math and science on the idea that we have certain sense perceptions and put them together in certain ways. Even mathematical truths become empirical generalizations. How do you know that 2 plus 2 equals 4? You know that 2 plus 2 equals 4 because 99 times in your past experience, when you've added two apples to two apples, they've come out 4. Now, it may be that next time you'll find that they come out 5, but so far as you know, according to the habits of your past experience, they've come out to be 4. That's a bit of a caricature, but that's about where he's at. It's more sophisticated, but that's about the kind of idea he's working with. So the empiricists keep going on through the 19th century, and they have an enormous influence on language analysis, which is the next big thing I'm going to talk about. Realism is an attempt to synthesize. Well, it's an attempt to. You see, again, you have this problem of rationalism and empiricism. You have the idealists who are basically rationalists, and then you have the empiricists who are constantly criticizing these operations of reason. And now I think you have an attempt at another synthesis by the realists, following just as Kant tried to reconcile rationalism and empiricism in his day. So the realists tried to reconcile these two things in their own day. And there are some names that are associated with their movement. The realists look at both the idealists and the Kantians and the empiricists, and they say, look, you guys are all going about this the wrong way. You're asking about the process by which our judgments are formed. You're all basically psychologists. You're all describing the workings of the mind by which our judgments are formed. You talk about how we get these sense data in and how we work with them and how we develop inadequate ideas into more adequate ideas. You're giving biography. You're showing how people go about making up their minds. But that's not what we're interested in. As philosophers, we don't really care about this process. That's just psychology. What we're interested in are the criteria by which we determine what is real and what's not real. What we're interested in is the normative question of how we make judgments, how we ought to make judgments. Not how we make judgments, but how we ought to make judgments about the real. So the realists say, look, don't ask the causes of your ideas, simply accept them from wherever they come, whether they come from sense experience or reasoning or dialectical reasoning or whatever. Just accept your ideas wherever they come from and analyze those ideas. This is and when you do that, you discover, when you analyze your ideas, you discover that an essential feature of them is to refer beyond themselves. Every idea is an idea of something. And what are these ideas of? Well, they're ideas of all kinds of things. Things, relationships, properties, numbers, classes, possibilities, fictions, hallucinations, propositions, time, space, and so on and so forth. So you can work out your metaphysics on that basis. You know what things are real. When you examine your ideas, you see what they refer to. You group them into classes. You classify them. And you see some of the relationships between the different classifications. This is like dialectical philosophy in a way. And it's sort of like idealism in that you have the mind studying its own ideas to find out what is real. But it's unlike both the idealists and the empiricists, because you do have something out there for the mind to refer to. You have something real out there, and that's why it's called realism. This then filters into phenomenology, which filters into existentialism later on. It also has some influence on language analysis. So you can say that language analysis and existentialism have one common ancestor, namely 19th century realism.